I'm going to talk about Tolstoy and something that quite a few of you have heard me do a number of times before. Hopefully this will be one of the last times that I do it. but in relation to some of the things that I think have come out of the project that I've been working on that relate to integrity. I've got a group of Tolstoyans and Tolstoy here behind me. The Tolstoy family spent the winter of 1881 in Moscow. And this was at a point where Tolstoy was several years already into his spiritual crisis and the development of his Christian anarchist principles. He didn't like spending time in town, and what he did while he was there was to make a number of visits to Moscow's slum districts, and he also got involved in the supervision of the Moscow census. He was really outraged at the idea that relatively wealthy young people who were involved in the census were going into the homes of the Moscow poor to ask these fairly mundane statistical questions about people's lives and circumstances while many of the people were struggling to feed their families. But he also rejected institutional solutions and philanthropy, because while acts of charity, it seemed to him, in the countryside where he spent a lot of his life, might make some kind of impact, he was rapidly coming to the conclusion that certainly in the city they were completely worthless, and that if one wanted to help the poor, there was only one solution to that, and that was not to keep them in a state of poverty by relying on their labour and denying them the necessities of life, but instead to get off men's backs to work to provide for one's own needs and also for the needs of others. So I have a passage, if you flip on the next slide, Joe, from What Then Must We Do, which is a book that Tolstoy wrote about these experiences in the years that followed. So he says, "First of all, to the question, what must we do, I replied to myself, I must not lie either to myself or to others, nor fear the truth wherever it may lead me. We all know what lying to other people means, and yet we lie unceasingly from morning till night. Not at home, when I am at home, very pleased, when I'm not at all pleased, my respect, when I do not respect, I have no money, when I have some, and so on. We consider lies to other people, especially certain kinds of lies, to be bad, but are not afraid of lying to ourselves. Yet the very worst, most downright and deceptive lie to others is as nothing in its consequences compared with that lie on which we have built our whole life. Not to lie means not to fear the truth, not to invent excuses to hide from myself the conclusions of reason and conscience, and not to accept such excuses when they're invented by others. Not to fear to differ from all those around me, or to be left alone with reason and conscience, and not to fear the position to which truth will lead me, believing firmly that whatever truth and conscience will lead me to, however strange it may be, cannot be worse than what is based on falsehood." In 1894, to give another example, Tolstoy published The Kingdom of God is Within You, a treatise which dealt explicitly with refusal to perform military service. Individuals who refused to serve, both in Russia and in other continental countries, when military service was compulsory, were particularly important to Tolstoy because he saw them as leaders in a kind of revolution of individuals who were standing up against church and state. Everybody, he said, knew what was right, i.e. not to kill, not to go to war, but people clung through inertia to the kind of old forms of life. And what was actually needed was for everyone individually to stand up and to do what they knew was right and to refuse to fight. So lobbying governments and organising peace organisations or societies, or propagandising in favour of peace, absolutely pointless. The question is solely the one that faces somebody who is invited to go to war and who should refuse. So this is a quote from this text in which he says, "Men often think the question of resistance or non-resistance to evil by violence is an invented question which can be avoided. But it's a question life presents to all men, and it demands an answer from every thinking man. From the time the Christian doctrine was preached, that question has stood for men in their social life, as the question stands for a traveller when he reaches a fork in the road he's been following." We get to a lot of forks in roads in these various texts, that's also explained to us what we should do next. But he cannot say, "I will not think about it, but will go on just as I did before. There was only one road formerly, and now there are two, and it is impossible to go on as before. He must choose one over the other. In just the same way, since Christ's teaching has become known to me, it's impossible to say, I will live as I did before, without deciding the question of resistance or non-resistance to evil by violence." So these two texts deal with quite different things, and they're both just part of a kind of Tolstoyan canon, which is written in the last 30 years of Tolstoy's life, Which includes volumes and all kinds of different aspects of his new worldview. So, including obviously sort of peace and social inequality, but also vegetarianism, temperance, chastity, art, and so on. And Tolstoy, as hopefully we can see there, asks his readers to follow their own conscience and reason, not to obey external laws if they disagree with them, not to deceive themselves, so if they know what's right, it's their obligation to act on that, rather than to sort of deny it or try to ignore it or just carry on doing what they were doing before or behaving in a way that conventional society demanded. And in return, he offered his readers what seemed to a lot of them to be a fairly complete kind of world view, a philosophy that offered very uncompromising solutions to their concerns in all kinds of different sorts of spheres of life. So I suppose those are three ways in which I think this relates to integrity, that it's about following your own reason and conscience, but it's about making sure that your actions align with those principles, and that also it's about this sort of integral, kind of comprehensive worldview. So his polemics inspired readers in Russia, but also across Europe and America, to change their lives, abandon their careers, and to go into enterprises where they tried to put these newfound principles into practice. Their experiences and the debates and activities that they engaged in, I think, shed some kind of light on some of the questions that we're interested in today. So things like the demands of integrity and its limits, and the consequences to some of these people of having to compromise, and the obstacles that trying to behave with complete integrity put in the way of interacting with others, and also perhaps in the way of actually converting them to your cause. So I'm going to talk here first a little bit about the role that a search for integrity played in Tolstoyan sort of conversion experiences, and then a little bit about some theoretical difficulties and some practical difficulties that Tolstoyans faced when they were trying to put their beliefs into practice, and then finally a little bit about what became of some of these people who lived through this movement and then did other things afterwards. You want to flick on to the next one? It's just a picture to entertain you while I talk about conversions, which is a bunch of books kind of indicating reading and conversion. So one of the things that I did as part of this project was to collect a lot of accounts written by individuals of their conversion experiences, if you like, after reading Tolstoy's work. There are lots of people who read and were very deeply impressed by what Tolstoy had to say. But the ones that I'm talking about really are people who took it so seriously that they wanted to change their lives as a result, rather than just kind of going through some kind of crisis and then getting over it. So these accounts are quite consciously described as conversion accounts or enlightenment experiences. And a lot of them are written down, I suppose, because they occupy quite an important position, perhaps for the individual, but also within the movement, because they made very good copy for Tolstoy newspapers and things like that, and pamphlet literature as a kind of inspirational example for others to draw on. So I collected quite a lot of these, and I tried to do some analysis about things like, you know, the age and the background and so on of some of the people who were involved. I also read quite a lot of literature about conversion theory to try and see if I could find a model into which some of these people's experiences might fit. And that was quite difficult, because those models tend to emphasise that such a conversion would probably be like a solution to a pre-existing period of crisis, or that it would perhaps be something that was characteristic of a lot of peer pressure being put on the individual. Some of the individuals that I'm looking at do talk about elements of sort of personal crisis or vulnerability beforehand. Others make it clear that they were already engaged in some kind of spiritual quest. And you also have people who will say, well, I'd already reached these conclusions and I read Tolstoy and he said the same thing that I already thought. But the most common ones are ones in which the individual is or is portrayed as being quite comfortable and kind of sailing along in their life until they read Tolstoy and this new understanding of life is revealed to them. And the emphasis in the majority of cases is firmly on the influence of the text. So Isabella Mayo, who's a Tolstoy in Aberdeen talks about the revelation that it brought about when one's inner consciousness instantly affirms a new truth presented to one. They usually describe it as being quite sudden experiences. There's little or no social pressure to convert, and in fact, usually the opposite is true. But the pressure would be there to sort of, you know, maintain the kind of conventional behaviour, keep your job, or so on. And obviously, the advocate of this new philosophy is only very remotely involved in the process. There are a couple of sort of fits, one of which is with a discussion of moral conversions, where search for value in one's life or for moral integrity or a drive to kind of make your own moral judgments drives this move away from kind of self-interest towards perhaps the kind of position that these people are taking. They have a lot in common with the phenomenon, and there's some literature on this, of kind of conversions to socialism in the 1880s and 1890s. Stephen Yeo's written about that. The fact that they're often narrated in religious language, often driven again by the reading of a sort of seminal socialist text. So Friedrich van Eeden describes this as a moral event, and he says, we live, he says, in a state of somnambulism. We may be said to know, but not yet to feel or to realise the injustice of our position. A slight shock to our mind is sometimes able to wake us up and open our eyes to the disagreement between our confessed morals and our actual mode of living. The pushing force comes from the men of faith and a force of character. The mind may be prepared intellectually, but it wants ethical incitement to change its potential energy into active movement. Lots of these commentaries make clear the importance of Tolstoy's kind of confessional style and the lack of dogma and preaching, and this kind of sense that the author is sharing an experience with you, inviting your participation. And after all, Tolstoy is a novelist, so he ought to be reasonably good at kind of moving or persuading his reader in this way. Chekhov, who was quite taken with Tolstoy philosophy for a while, spoke about Tolstoy's kind of reasonableness and also this kind of hypnotism that he felt had caused him to adopt those views. But if the language was very reasonable, the solutions that are being offered were very uncompromising, and that is, it seems, a kind of unifying element in the way that people speak in these conversion experiences about it, that Tolstoy's polemics seem to answer a lot of contradictions for people that were reading them, whether they were businessmen or shopkeepers or aristocrats or soldiers, or in some cases already members of the socialist movement, that he didn't allow for any compromise between their ideals and their actions, and that he resolved all the doubts that they had. And the other thing that crops up very often is this idea of Tolstoy philosophy offering a kind of robust and very complete worldview. So Tolstoy is engaged with a very broad range of reformist causes, from pacifism through to temperance and dress reform and diet. But a lot of these people writing will say, well, you know, the work of all these small societies working on one thing or another is all very well. But actually, and this is a quote from John Kenworthy, one of the leading British Tolstoyans, all these people, humanitarians, socialists, vegetarians, anti-vivisectionists, teetotalers, land reformers, and all such seekers of human welfare, needed to be aware that their efforts were but a detail of the whole work of social regeneration, and that we cannot rightly understand and direct our own little piece of effort unless we know and pursue it as part of the great whole. And Percy Redfern, who in 1900 set up the Manchester Tolstoy Society, said about his rationale for doing that, quite defensively, because he was writing to Tolstoy, who was telling him he shouldn't set up a Tolstoy Society. He said, now I can temporarily associate with different groups like vegetarians, socialists, land reformers, rationalists, theosophists, Wesleyans, and so forth. If I had some definite bias towards any particular material reform, that might contempt me, but I want to face life as a whole. That we cannot do in mixed societies in which we must not introduce controversial subjects foreign to the particular aims of that society. So in addition to working occasionally with particular bodies, one seeks society with others who also wish to face life as a whole, hence the Tolstoy Society. Okay, so I'm going to say a little bit about theoretical questions and then a little bit about practical questions. The principle that underlay all those different reforms, areas of reform in which Tolstoyans were interested, is this principle of non-resistance to evil by violence. So not non-violent resistance, but complete non-violence, complete non-resistance to any kind of force or evil. And that informed their beliefs on coercion in all kinds of different spheres, like the use of money, obedience to laws, punishment, education, marriage, and so on and so on. But the commitment to non-resistance in its very fundamental form was one of the first struggles that Tolstoy's followers faced when they accepted his philosophy. And that happens in everyday life and in sort of social and commercial transactions. So I have one example, which is a chap called Johannes van der Veer, who was in England in 1899 and wrote a letter to Vladimir Chirkov where he is talking about the fact that he had missed his train to Gloucester, where there was a Tolstoyan colony, because while he'd been on the platform, the feeling had struck him that if truly he was a non-resistant, then he shouldn't really be pushing ahead of other people and rushing to get on the train to get seats. And so he'd missed the train, but he had remained truly non-resistant. So in all kinds of practical interactions, it features. But it also remains a central point of discussion in lectures and meetings and in the pages of Tolstoyan newspapers well into the 1900s. And these debates take place both within the movement and also people sort of on the fringes or outside who most often are attacking the Tolstoyans for this belief. Most of those discussions centre around the idea of what they call the man who ran amok. So a test case for whether you're prepared to follow this non-resistant principle to its logical conclusion. Is it really wrong to act to restrain somebody who intends to kill you or kill your wife or kill your child? A lot of Tolstoyans struggled to be orthodox on that issue. So Elwin Ward, for example, said that the more of Tolstoy's articles on non-resistance he translated, the more he believed that to use physical force was sometimes the best thing we can do. For him, he said it was the motive and not the action that was important. The true principle is not that force and violence must never be used, but that the motive actuating each thought and action should be to benefit and not to injure mankind. One contributor to The Open Road, which is a Tolstoyan magazine, said the mistake was to assume that non-resistance was identical with love of one's neighbour. Physical force, they said, could also be guided by love. George Bernard Shaw, who waded into this debate, he was an admirer of Tolstoy and a vegetarian, but hardly a Tolstoyan, said that he accepted this idea that there was an output of evil in men's actions. So if someone starts to blacken your eyes, he says, if you begin to blacken his, the output is doubled. Then there are two violent men in the street instead of one. But the way to correct the man's behaviour, he believed, was to hand him over to the police, who would cure him of his bad tendency. And as for the man who couldn't behave himself, without having other people's time wasted in preventing him from doing wrong things, we should not punish him, we should kill him. Or as John Bruce Wallace, who was also on the fringes of the Tolstoyan movement, put it about 7 years earlier, rehearsing the same argument, one might feel the utmost tenderest compassion, the purest benevolence towards a dangerous homicidal maniac, and yet out of regard to one's fellow men, not hesitate for a moment as to preventing him walking abroad with a loaded rifle. Orthodox Tolstoyans railed against that belief that the ends justifies the means. So for them it was the spirit in which the action that was performed that counted and not the eventual outcome. Isabella Mayo lamented that the world is poisoned by this idea that it's possible to do evil and secure good, from governments seeking to maintain order to individuals seeking to obtain freedom. Even philanthropists, physicians and preachers all suffer from the same malady. Since one could never correctly predict the result of an action, Vladimir Chirkov said it was the moral purity of your action that counted. And if coercion sometimes appeared useful, that was an illusion, as one could not foresee all the consequences of one's action. There's also a lot of discussion about the difference between physical force and moral force. So a lot of Tolstoyans very passionately believe that they ought to be converting public opinion and persistently sort of speaking the truth about the state of things. But on the other hand, this question of sort of verbal coercion or persuasion, for some people, was problematic. So Jane Addams, for example, who spent a lot of time debating this with various Tolstoyans, felt that Tolstoy was distinguishing too clearly between the two things, and that actually, shouldn't we be avoiding forcing our views onto others? and condemning them if they disagreed with us, because in a way that was a form of resistance. She talked about non-resistance as selecting the good in the neighbourhood and refraining from railing at the bad, and she in fact maintained that the kind of anticipation of conflict between oneself and society, so the expectation of opposition, the expectation of martyrdom, and holding oneself kind of ready for that was in itself a sort of resistance that worked a kind of evil, and was at best very negative. Okay, Tolstoy's refusal to participate in any kind of political or governmental or legal process divided them very clearly from other reformers, from anti-vivisectionists, for example, because they couldn't condone legislative solutions, from pacifists because they didn't see any point in arbitration or lobbying for disarmament. It divided them from members of the socialists and even members of the cooperative movement because they disapproved of organisation or political representation. And there are extensive sort of debates about that, about, you know, the perceived waste that they created by not involving themselves politically, and the fact that they might then be handing over power effectively to reactionary forces. Members of those other movements didn't really regard them as just a benign irritation either. They quite often were very irritated and scathing about the damage that Tolstoyism was doing to their movement, because it was taking people away who might be actively sort of participating. In their interactions with each other as well, and the outside world, Tolstoyans also faced threats to the integrity of their principles and their practices. Their publishing enterprises were a case in point. So Posrednik, which was the principal Tolstoyan publishing house in Russia, benefited enormously from the involvement of a guy called Leon Sitin, who was a commercial publisher who had very extensive trade connections, access to a network of salesmen who distributed books in the countryside. And he very much welcomed the opportunity to apply his business expertise to this project that he thought had quite a moral worth. But he never entirely distanced himself from his commercial operations. And some of those involved the publication of precisely the kind of material that the Tolstoyans were trying to combat. So other leading Tolstoyans involved in that enterprise were very hostile to aspects of his work, and eventually they dispensed with his services, and therefore the quality of their publications and distribution also suffered. And likewise, Arthur Diffield, who was the manager of the English Tolstoyan publishing house, the Free Age Press, sought to steer a course between managing an ethical business and managing a successful one. The Tolstoyan opposition to copyright was a particular problem for him. It made newspaper editors and publishers really reluctant to take the material that he was providing. And he wrote that, "Of course I know no copyright is the ideal, just as giving the books away without any charge is the ideal. Getting the paper made for nothing, composing, printing, binding, distributing and living without financial relations are the ideal. And as we compromise on these points, knowing it is compromise, yet yielding because the development of the general consciousness has not yet reached the point where those who feed, clothe, house, make paper, print for us, cease to impose their wills on us. So the events of the last few months have shown me that the human consciousness has also not reached the point where the imposition of our will on newspaper editors, translators, booksellers can be effected without bad results, both to the writers, those willed upon, and the spread of the ideas." I feel okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at least 5 minutes.
Likewise, the Tolstoyans who established communal agricultural enterprises faced challenges to their principles and challenges in putting them into practice. Since following the dictates of one's own conscience was such an important feature of the Tolstoyan worldview, Tolstoyan communities often embraced quite a broad range of different beliefs and practices. I've got a quote about this on the next slide. Sorry, I think that last picture was supposed to demonstrate something about people debating things in meeting. But this is a quote from Yelena Sheshinyeva, describing life at the New Jerusalem commune outside Moscow. This was founded in the 20s, where she says, "Vanya Zuyev tempered his body by sleeping in winter on the balcony, eating raw vegetables and seeds and using absolutely no cooked food. He thought that was more healthful and convenient. Seryozha Alexeyev did not cut his hair, and once he suddenly decided to go around completely without clothes, believing the natural state would strengthen chastity and cultivate a healthy view of sexual difference. A few of us didn't eat milk, wishing to have no part in cattle raising, and consequently in the killing of young bulls and old cows that were good for nothing but their meat. Except for me, all the others just mentioned wouldn't wear leather boots for the same reason. That is, because they wanted to be consistent vegetarians all the way. Nobody made fun of anybody else. We respected each other's views. But the question of differing beliefs and different occupations and organisation weren't always so easily solved. So, for example, in the British Tolstoy movement, there were a whole range of different views about marriage and sex, which caused numerous disputes and controversies. Some hard workers resented those that they felt weren't doing as much as they should be to get enterprises onto a self-sufficient footing. And actually, that question of organisation itself was fundamentally problematic. Self-sufficiency, people who were trying to organise it would argue, required organisation. A commitment to complete non-resistance required that there be no organisation. So Tolstoy and colonists either entered into communal projects with quite little clarity about how the society that they wanted to create ought to operate, or they worked that out in a lot of detail and therefore effectively compromised the ideal. And the ultimate tests of that came from external threats that required colonists to protect themselves and abandon the principle of non-resistance, or to observe it and then watch their projects fail. So there are lots of examples of this. At White Way in Gloucestershire, there's an incident where one of the investors falls out with the colonists and tries to take away their cows that he has paid for in an attempt to reclaim some of the money, and of course they have to let him take the cows. They can't resist his taking the cows. They have a lot of fights with their neighbours over the destruction of their crops by their neighbours' livestock. One of the most extreme examples is at the Christian Commonwealth in Georgia in the USA, where some of the members petitioned for the colony to be put into receivership because they wanted to claim their share of the value of the land. And the existing colonists were torn between opposing those people in court and therefore abandoning the principle of non-resistance, or not opposing them and not opposing the claim that was being made and therefore allowing the colony to be broken up and destroyed. They opted to defend the case, and Ralph Albertson, who was one of the founding members of that colony, said if it had been about horses or money or property, they wouldn't have prosecuted them, but this was an attempt to destroy the community entirely. It wasn't a situation that could be met by anything in our philosophy, he said. If we were to live, we had to fight. It was the end of our dream of strictly obeying the Sermon on the Mount. The decision to contest it really poisoned the atmosphere at the Commonwealth, and it also alienated a lot of prominent supporters. So the fan mail that they had formerly received turned to criticism about their loss of ideals, which Albertson caricatured as follows. He says, "It was too bad, they said, that so glorious an ideal should have been given up so easily. Would it not have been possible with a little more love, with a little more tact, to keep those kickers from rebellion? Is not such love possible? You were going to show us, we hope, that it was. Well, we're hurt. Our faith is hurt. We're almost, but not quite, broken-hearted as we sit here in our office in the northern city and dictate this letter to our stenographer. Naturally, we shall take less interest in what you are doing, with all good wishes and so forth." At the International Brotherhood of Blaricum in the Netherlands, another Tolstoyan project, there was an instant actual violence which caused the commune to collapse, in which numerous colonists were involved, when Brotherhood residents ripped up the rails of the steam train that ran past the colony as an expression of sympathy with striking railway men, and their neighbours, fishermen and farmers who needed to transport their goods to market, attacked the colony, even launching a firebomb at one resident who demonstratively sat reading his Bible. And the ensuing debate about what measures to take to defend the colony inevitably led to its demise. Okay, finally, just a little bit about the trajectories of some of these people after they're involved in this movement. And I've got another couple of quotes. The first one from Johannes van der Veer, again, one of my favourites, which he says, "It's the first time I speak of it in public. Gives me much pain, but I feel I must do it, for I will now cry out aloud that a consistent application of the Tolstoyan doctrine must lead to one of the following consequences: perishing in miserable wretchedness, growing mad, or making away with oneself." I want to try to avoid building this kind of obvious trajectory here of idealism followed by experience, followed by disillusion and defeat, because that is something that's characteristic of quite a lot of discussions of Tolstoyan enterprises. And I've tried in what I've done, maybe not to challenge it, but at least maybe tried to complicate it a little bit by looking at what people did next in their lives and what kinds of things they took from their experience in the Tolstoyan movement and how they reflected on it. So the movement did drive some of its members into bankruptcy. It did seriously affect their mental health. Some, like Van der Veer, completely renounced their former beliefs. He concluded that Tolstoy's instruction to reject all material well-being, to always put others before oneself, was contrary to human nature. What was the use, he said, of propagating a theory which demanded the impossible? He joined the Dutch Social Democratic Party, convinced that socialism, which has in view the happiness of all men, was a sound view with which the future lies, and that of the Tolstoyans, a sentimental view which will necessarily die out in or near the near future. Elmer Maud agreed that it was impossible to live the Tolstoyan philosophy. He said, "We should use our profits as we use our minds, seeking and valuing the veins of rich ore and wasting as little time as possible on sand and earth or impractical conclusions that we find on our search." Prince Kropotkin, who corresponded with Maud about this, disagreed, and he wrote to him that Tolstoy's greatness lay precisely in having come to the conclusions about life that he came to. Of compromises between a high ethics and Philistinism, we have only too many. Every Philistine household and every sixpenny novel is a commentary upon them. The question is, must these compromises go on unaffected till mankind becomes all through a race of double-tongued sophists and we go towards that? Or must we get hold of an ideal and see whether there are not means to bring that ideal into life? There were nevertheless many individuals who continued to quietly apply their principles as best they could in their own lives and in interactions with others, rather than through grand schemes. G.D. Laurie, a retired railway official at Carlisle, wrote in 1913 that Tolstoy is still foremost in my estimation as a teacher of the true life. His advice in practical affairs of life is always right, I think. Florence Worland and her husband Charles Daniel continued their publishing enterprises well into the 1920s, catering for new and cranky reform interests. So they got involved in penal reform, in dietary reform, reform of education, and took, I would say, some of the Tolstoyan principles into that, while also retaining a focus on Tolstoy and maintaining contact with other Tolstoyans that remained. Can you press it one more time? Should you give us another quote, which is from Florence Daniel, in which she says, reflecting on her experience, that Tolstoy ruined not those who took him, who didn't take him seriously, but those who did not take him seriously enough. Only those in whom there was no guile went through the Tolstoy movement and came out the other side in full possession of sanity and integrity, albeit not Tolstoyans. Mm-hmm.